This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and today we start with rent control. It's a subject that evokes strong feelings, and now that Boston Mayor Michelle Wu has offered a home rule petition to tie annual rent increases to inflation and cap those rent increases at 10%, the debate is fully on. Now, Wu's home rule petition ultimately has to have the support of the Boston City Council, the state legislature, and Governor Maura Healey. So, what are the core arguments here? What do we actually know? And is there a way to protect vulnerable renters and landlords and the housing stock? We want to talk about that today. Jesse Kanson-Beninov is with the advocacy group Abundant Housing Massachusetts. State Representative Mike Conley is of Cambridge, a member of the state legislature's Joint Committee on Housing and a longtime renter. And Doug Quattrochi is executive director of the trade association Mass Landlords and a landlord himself. They're all here in Studio 2. Jesse, good to meet you.
Good to meet you. Thanks for having me.
Doug, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
And Mike, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks for having us.
All right, so I'm going to sort of structure our conversation here, and I'm going to start. First question is going to be a one-word answer. Second question is going to be a whole sentence, so it gets better as it goes. But for this first question, I want to just start with first principles. So yes or no, putting any specific policy proposals aside, is there a way to protect vulnerable renters and landlords and the housing stock? Is this the problem that can actually be solved? Yes or no, Jesse?
Yes.
Yes. Doug?
Yes.
And Mike?
Yes.
Okay, so that's, so there is a way to do this. Now we're just down to, so what is that way? And is it a way that everybody can kind of move forward on? Okay, so next, I want to do a fill in the blank. And this is kind of a one sentence thing. The most important element in solving that problem is X, Mike.
A comprehensive approach to the housing emergency that includes housing production, tenant protections, and new revenue to make public investments in affordable housing.
That was actually one sentence. I'm impressed. All right. And Doug, you.
Short term, we need rental assistance. And long term, we need zoning reform.
Okay. How about you, Jesse?
We need to build more homes in the city of Boston and across the region.
Okay. So if I'm hearing you, then the sort of the, if we put on the table all the pieces of a package that are what's necessary to get to a point where vulnerable renters are safe, landlords have what they need, and we have sufficient and protected housing stock. We need zoning reforms. We need new housing. We need financial investment, and we need some sense of security. Is that fair? Okay, great. So that kind of gets it out on the table, especially for listeners who no, they feel some way about this, but this is not an easy policy discussion to follow if you're not sitting in it in the middle of every day. All right, so now, Jesse, in your mind, what is the core driver of getting new housing built? Because that's the piece that you really emphasized.
Yeah, the reality is that we have an incredible shortage of homes in Boston and across Massachusetts, and that is what's driving to a large degree, the housing crisis. It gives property owners incredible control over the market because they don't have to compete, in particularly in the rental market, for tenants. Wealthier folks can come in and bid up the cost of housing. That drives displacement and gentrification, which we struggle with throughout our region and our state. And ultimately, if we build more homes and we decrease or actually rather increase the vacancy rate, it actually forces property owners to be more competitive and think about how to lower the cost and retain, attract and retain tenants.
So Doug Quattrochi, that's an emphasis on new housing stock.
Yeah, absolutely. And that makes sense and is something we agree with.
But now let's talk about existing housing stock. From your perspective, Mass Landlords, what's the imperative on existing housing stock?
Well, existing housing stock needs a lot of work to be made lead safe and to be made zero emissions, and we are very far from that. So it's a really kind of a daunting challenge when you look at how are we supposed to upgrade all our housing. We've got a lot of really old buildings. And you look back at pictures, you know, talk about zoning reform, you look back at pictures from the last 100 years, Massachusetts looks pretty much the same because a lot of this housing has just been exactly as it was originally designed, trying to subdivide it inside a little bit, but it hasn't had real overhaul. It hasn't been a lot of real construction. So we've got a lot of deferred maintenance.
And Jesse, essentially, do you agree with Doug that zoning reform is going to be a key piece of this picture?
Oh, it's huge. And it's what we at Abundant Housing Massachusetts focus most of our energy on. It's zoning reform to build more homes, zoning reform to build more homes for people at all income levels, as well as like the representative said, investing in affordable and deeply affordable housing as well. And they go hand in hand.
All right. So, Mike Connolly, I'll turn over to you now. And in a minute, I'm going to loosen this up. I'm going to really open it up because we're going to start playing with the proposals that are on the table. But I just want to get these first principles down. One of the things you really emphasized was public investment, new money. Why? Where does it go? And do you think we have the will right now? I mean, Governor Maura Healey just put out her budget proposal yesterday with rent in mind as a key thing. So how much? What focus? Et cetera.
Well, we need a great deal of public investment. And I actually believe we need a public developer. You know, personally, I grew up in public housing built and financed by the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. We don't make the same level of public investment in housing that we made generations ago.
So I'm going to reveal my ignorance here. I did not know that there was a time when we had a state-level public developer and that we do not now. Is that correct?
We built state public housing, and it was done in partnership with local housing authorities, but there was definitely a state program, and we've moved away from that. One of the bills that I've introduced this session on Beacon Hill is the Massachusetts Social Housing Act, and it would create a state developer that could build social housing. And this could work in companion with the market to help fill gaps that the market just isn't going to address.
What does the phrase social housing mean?
Social housing is publicly owned housing, but it's also for a range of incomes. Essentially, it's not just for poor people. And in the United States of America, the original concept of public housing was supposed to be housing for everyone. And it was actually the real estate industry that decided to lobby to make public housing just for low-income folks.
All right. Anybody confirm, deny, refute what? Because, again, this is a piece of the history that I don't know.
Absolutely. You know, just to add to what Mike said, I mean, Massachusetts is unique in that we're one of the few states that has a state-owned public housing portfolio, completely independent of HUD, the federal government. And it is unique, and it's been incredibly divested for decades now. So absolutely agree with him.
And I could just add that in the state of Rhode Island, they have now piloted a public developer as of last year, and they're moving forward with proposals for that. And apparently the Senate president in Rhode Island supports this. So I think this is an idea that can gain traction.
Doug Quattrocci.
In terms of advocacy, one of the biggest challenges we have had in Massachusetts is this split type of housing experience where most of the Massachusetts residents have single family homes that they own and live in. And so a lot of the folks who operate in the rental housing space kind of get marginalized as a group. And so the largest advocacy that is at play here is really to keep that, like you said, Representative, that public housing kind of at the margins, rental housing at the margins, because there's this kind of misperception that having rental housing distributed through neighborhoods is somehow bad or undesirable, and it's anything but.
All right, so I want to bring tenant advocate voices in here. Mike Leyba is of City Life Vida Urbana. He was on GBH last month. Here's a little sound.
Everything is getting more expensive. We have to draw the line somewhere. And the place that we draw the line is where we say, you should not take away access to this critical, life-saving need that people have. That's where we say the line is. You should not take away something that is somebody's ability to remain stably housed, to keep their kids in school, to remain a voter, to access their job and healthcare.
So I hear in that two things. I hear not only affordability, but I also hear eviction. And as we now move into specific policy proposals, I want to start talking in that space because at some level, regardless of one's perspective, given that we know the three things that we need to preserve, right, the housing stock, landlords' ability to thrive, and protections for renters and vulnerable renters, is there anything actually objectionable in what Mike Leyba just said? Mike Connolly.
Absolutely not. Housing should be a human right, and we've made decisions in Massachusetts to provide. We were the first public schools. We established the notion that you could have universal access to health care, and we need to pursue comprehensive policies that ensure universal access to housing, and rent stabilization is just one component of a much larger picture.
Doug Quattrocci.
Right. That's what it means to live in a commonwealth.
And Jesse.
Yeah, I agree with everything I heard in that statement. And I, you know, would say that the reality is it becomes not a human right when we live in a state which has a critical shortage of homes and then gives all of the power to set prices to those property owners and to the wealthiest competitors in the market, wealthier renters and homeowners.
So this is such a fascinating moment we're in then, right? And I have actually moderated big rent control debates in the past, right? And I find this to be the case every time I moderate or have a conversation like this. Everybody agrees on first principles. Nobody disagrees what the urgency and the needs are. But man, it becomes a food fight when the rubber meets the road on policy. Doug Quattrocci, you're at Mass Landlords. Why?
Well, I think for us, it's really because a lot of landlords are roll-up-their-sleeves types that maybe aren't the most eloquent communicators, and we want to get invited to these places where we can have input, but we don't provide input in a way that other people can understand kind of what we go through. And that's kind of what Mass Landlords is about. You know, we put the flower in our logo. We're trying to indicate that we're serious about doing the right thing here, even if we don't come across the best way possible.
And I want to note that that is basically, I would argue, the basis of what I've heard you make in the argument in the lawsuit that Mass Landlords has filed against the city of Boston for the approach to the proposal that Boston Mayor Michelle Wu brought forward. And we have some sound from Mayor Wu about that. I've talked to her face-to-face earlier this week, but I want to get your layout on this first.
Sure. Well, so a year ago, the mayor announced the Rent Stabilization Advisory Committee. We don't get invited to every organization or committee or whatever, so we weren't really hurt, but we did kind of wonder how the folks got appointed who did get appointed. And so we filed a public records request that says, from the year before when the committee was announced, show us the emails to the city or from the city to the people who are named so that we can investigate and learn whether there was, you know, any kind of lobbying pressure or advocacy or just a sense of already they knew each other. And surprisingly, the city didn't respond. So we got the state supervisor of records involved, and the state supervisor ordered the city to produce the emails. We're fortunate to live in a state where we have access to public records, certainly at the municipal level, to make sure that everything's going above board. So the city produced a response that was kind of, in our eyes, gaslighting. They said, well, here's an email. But what they should have done under the public records law, if there were more, is they should have said, and here's all the rest of them. Or if there were none others, they should have said, and there's nothing else.
So that's what the suit is about, is to get the rest of those.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
So I want to say two things here. One, I said directly to Mayor Wu when she was here on Monday, there must be more emails than one. And she said, we will absolutely comply with the public records law. We will bring all emails forward. So I just want to put that on the record because I asked her about it. I also asked her about the process because the voices, and I'm going to turn to you on this, Representative Mike Conley, the voices in the seat at the table matter in this moment. Here's part of what she had to say.
The committee members represent a wide range of interests and professional experiences, and each of those meetings was public, and the results only then fed into a proposal that still has to go through the actual formal public process of city council hearings and potential vote and then state processes as well.
Just react to that.
You know, I think this conversation about emails is off to the side. You know, this was a bill drafting process. Anyone could participate. There were many listening sessions. This was a process that went on for over a year. And that was all simply to draft a bill that has now been presented to the Boston City Council. And they had a six-hour hearing last week, and they're having another hearing today.
So I want to bring in a little sound from that. This is Boston City Councilor Ruth Z. Louis-Jean speaking about Wu's proposal at a city council meeting last month. She's focusing on displacement.
We know that too many of our families, too many of our renters are being squeezed out and displaced from this city. And we can do something about that. We as government have a responsibility to make sure that we are building a city where everyone can not just survive, but really thrive, and making sure that we are preventing the rent gouging that we see increases that are really inexplicable and unjust.
It seems, Jesse Kansen-Beninov, that there should be a formula that keeps people from having their rents raised too much, that allows landlords, and I'm not even just going to say small landlords, although that's a big piece of this, and Doug Quattrocci, what you're representing here, but allows landlords who this is how they make their living, to make their living, that encourages additional housing stock. Why not do that? Is there some number out there where we can cap and create a safety net for everybody?
Yeah, you know, I think there's a really important point in the clip we just heard of Councillor Louis-Jean, where she used the term rent gouging. This is really an anti-rent gouging initiative, I believe, by the mayor. And whether we use the terms rent control, rent stabilization is a little bit of a distraction at times. I absolutely think there is a level, and we've seen it work in other places around the country, where you can allow for landlords, you know, to make the, you know, unfortunately, the profit that they need to pay for the costs of maintaining high quality housing for their renters, but also give the renters some consistency in what to expect in year over year rent increases. And, you know, I have a trouble, you know, believing that we necessarily need to have a system where landlords have to give $400 or $500 rent increases every year. If that's where we are, I think that's problematic.
Well, I was going to play a cut, but Doug, I want to get your response to that.
Well, so when we look at the folks who were on the committee to make this proposal, we see a lot of large donors, according to the Office of Campaign Political Finance. We see a lot of people with development interests, and we don't see anybody who operates the small housing, the wood frame construction. And so there's a lot more detail than just price cap here. And this is where we kind of really don't understand where the mayor is coming from, because landlords would not be allowed to renovate without permission from the rent control board and then would still be subject to rent control, whereas developers somehow not only don't need to go before the rent control board specifically to rebuild from the ground up, but also they're exempted from a period of 15 years from that new construction. So if this is about helping renters, why is there this difference in treatment between the size of real estate ownership?
Mike Connolly.
Well, I think, you know, there's two things on the table here. You know, I stand in solidarity with City Life and Right to the City when they say no one should be displaced. That should be our goal. At the same time, we have to understand that rent stabilization is one intervention that needs to be part of a layered, comprehensive approach. And for rent stabilization to pass on Beacon Hill, we need to convince all of our colleagues that we have struck a fair balance between tenants who are at risk of displacement, property owners, in particular small landlords, and developers of housing. And I honestly think that Mayor Wu gets that and that the proposal she put on the table is really brilliant in that respect. And of course, now the actual legislating process will begin and the Boston City Council can hear all the input and they can tinker with it and adjust it. But I definitely think we have to understand that rent stabilization won't solve all the problems, but it's a necessary intervention. And one quick thing I'll add, the Massachusetts legislature enacted a rent control act in the year 1920. We had rent control from World War II into the 1950s. We had it again from 1970 to 1994. So this is a common, normal policy that emerges in times of great housing distress.
Yeah, you say common. What I hear is cyclical, which I think is interesting. We've got a couple minutes left, so I want to give last words to everybody. Doug Quattrochi, Mass Landlords, go.
Well, General Law Chapter 40P already allows the mayor or any other municipality to have rent control. All they have to do is enact a system that compensates landlords the difference between the market rent and the controlled rent. That makes it rent control turned rental assistance. It's something we would support, and we've told folks this.
Okay, Mike Connolly, you.
I don't know that that's entirely accurate. That provision is part of something called the Rent Control Prohibition Act, and it says that if there was to be rent control under the Rent Control Prohibition Act, it would be entirely voluntary. And so,
voluntary by whom?
On the landlords to choose if they wish to participate.
Okay, and Jesse Canson-Bedenoff.
Yeah, you know, I just want to echo some of the comments that Rep. Connolly said. I think, you know, rent stabilization is part of a broader approach that we need, not just in the city of Boston, but across the state. I know there's hundreds of housing-related bills before the legislature right now. We have a bill that would create a housing production target in the state, would expand this MBTA communities multifamily zoning mandate, and do other things. We need to do that in concert with tenant protections. We need to desegregate the suburbs. There are so many housing-related issues that we need to deal with in this state, and this is just one of them.
Well, I appreciate the three of you coming to kind of lay out the urgency, the perspectives, where we agree, where the pain points are. I'm hoping that we'll be able to continue this conversation here on Radio Boston. For now, Representative Mike Conley is in the state legislature representing Cambridge, the 26th Middlesex. Jesse Kansen-Beninov is executive director of Abundant Housing, and Doug Quattrochi is executive director of Mass Landlords. Thanks to all three of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Wastewater data, new COVID cases, COVID hospitalization admissions are all down over the past 14 days across the Commonwealth. And that is good news. But COVID isn't gone. And for hospitals and healthcare systems, it's being joined by a number of other strains, from staffing shortages to tremendous pressure on the state's mental health care system, just to name a couple. Now, that means a big agenda for the new chair of the Massachusetts Health and Hospital Association, or MHA. They are a group of 70 Massachusetts hospitals that advocate and communicate with Beacon Hill and Capitol Hill. Christine Schuster is a nurse. She's run hospitals from Athol to Quincy, and in addition to being the new president or chair of MHA, is the president and CEO of Emerson Health, joins us now to sort of lay out, wow, what an agenda. Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here today to talk about something that's so important for every single person in the Commonwealth, and that's our healthcare system. At some point during everyone's lives, they're going to need to impact and access the healthcare system. So we need to be there for them and to be ready for them and to be there to serve. The challenges of COVID have made that so much more difficult for us. So the agenda of the Mass Hospital Association is to really work collaboratively amongst the hospitals and with our state and federal government to try to ensure that we can overcome some of the obstacles that COVID-19 has created for us.
So you are new to the role with MHA, but you also have run Emerson Health for a while, right? So pretend it's several months in, and now you've got to give a state of healthcare address the way the governor would give a state of the state or Mayor Wu might give a state of the city. We always listen for the state of the state. The Commonwealth is strong. If you had to give that about healthcare in the Commonwealth right now, would you say the state of the Commonwealth's healthcare is strong?
Clinically, you can't beat Massachusetts for healthcare expertise and quality. But in terms of the devastation the system has had over the past 3 years, it continues to be weakened by the infrastructure. And by that, I mean workforce. Workforce is by far our biggest challenge for so many reasons. We have had a decline in healthcare workers over the past few years. So, for example, people who may have worked an additional 3 to 5 years decided to retire early because they were afraid for their health. Perhaps they lived with someone who was immunosuppressed, or they had young children and they couldn't find care for them. So they decided to leave the workforce earlier. In addition, burnout is an issue for a number of our clinicians, you know, especially during the height of the COVID crisis. So as a result, our workforce has been weakened by this.
So I want to play a little sound of Iman Abu Zaid, CEO and co-founder of Incredible Health, speaking on a webinar with Boston Medical Center.
We are on track to be 1.1 million nurses short by the end of next year. The acute care nurse turnover, national average right now, is almost 19%. It has gone up over 2% over the last couple of years. So we're seeing unprecedented numbers, amounts in turnover. We're also seeing labor costs go up. So labor as a percentage of revenue right now is about 48% for publicly traded hospitals. And we're seeing wage increases happening, not just from temporary nurses, but also the permanent nurses. And then the average time to hire a permanent and specialized nurse right now in the U.S. on average is 89 days.
So that's one way, Christine Schuster, to size a shark about labor shortages and the pressure on labor. We wanted that one in particular because you are a nurse. What I want to understand underlying it all, when I hear you use the term, we have a problem with our infrastructure, right? Clinically, we're great. These are infrastructure problems. Normally, when I hear that, I think, okay, well, that means we've had disinvestment for 10, 20 years. These kinds of numbers, is it actually possible that just COVID did that? Or did we have a much bigger systemic problem that is now coming home to roost faster and worse because of COVID?
Excellent point. There has been a crumbling of the education system, especially for nurses, over the past several decades. And by that, I mean, even here at Boston University, where I went to the School of Nursing, it no longer exists. So we had schools of nursing closed because of the expense it takes to actually train nurses, smaller size classes, and so forth. We actually have a lack of instructors. So we have a number of people who would like to enter the profession of nursing. We don't have enough schools of nursing, and we certainly don't have enough instructors to train them. So that was all brewing. Lay a crisis with we have with COVID on top of that, and the pandemic and all that it's brought down on us, and you have a perfect storm for where we are today.
So that raises an interesting point. And I'll note, you talked about BU, so I'll just note BU holds the license here on WBUR. Okay, so the kinds of challenges that you're talking about, we can't fix in a year, right? You can't rebuild a nursing school in a year. You can't, and it takes years to educate a nurse to enter into the workforce. But we just heard 1.1 million nurses short by the end of next year. That feels like a math problem you can't solve. So what do we do?
So we have to have a collaboration and a partnership between government and the hospital systems to be able to do that. So I applaud our Governor Healey for the action she's taken and the budget she's proposed that will allow people to go back to school, community colleges. You know, if you're over 25, it's tuition free, and also a break in our college system for those entering college, because that's going to help. I think for the over 25 crowd, if you're looking for purpose, if you're looking for joy in your work, if you're looking to make a difference, becoming a technician or starting down the path of becoming an LPN or an RN, that will go a great way to helping to increase the numbers in the workforce. In many of our hospitals, we're doing what I call grow your own programs. So we're actually bringing staff in, educating them on certain specialties, the OR, the emergency department.
You mean non-nursing staff?
Nope, nursing staff, okay. Say new graduates.
Okay.
And helping to train them for certain specialty areas where we have acute shortages.
Where you might be particularly short.
Absolutely.
Okay.
So it's a combination of solutions that are going to help us to get through this crisis, and it won't be solved in a year.
So Christine Schuster is the new chair of the Massachusetts Health and Hospital Association, really taking over leadership, you know, at a really challenging time for the healthcare system in Massachusetts. One of the things that I noted is this is a one-year position, being chair of the MHA. Now, you are at Emerson Health. That is a role that will continue. But in taking this on, I have to assume that you must have thought, okay, in 1 year, there is something I can really get done. It's X. Am I right? And if so, what is X?
The beauty of healthcare in Massachusetts, and I've been involved in it for over 30 years, 24 years as a leader, is the collaboration amongst the leadership, and especially over the last 3 years. So while I happen to sit in the seat this year, before me, after me, I have incredible colleagues with the same vision, the same mission, and the same passion to continue this work. We're also very blessed, and I think yesterday, the new Secretary of Health and Human Services for Massachusetts is Kate Walsh. Kate is a longtime advocate for our patients and will be highly valuable to helping have that bridge between the hospitals and the government, our local government. And I know Attorney General Healey, now the governor, is for a long time been very concerned about our hospital system. And I know together that we will be able to find a solution for this over the coming years.
That optimism really is encouraging. At the same time, if there are 70 hospitals that are working together in collaboration this year, as a consumer of healthcare, I want to know there's a goal, right? What are you going to try to do this year? What are you going to try? What is, or if you want to frame it differently, what's the opportunity this year?
The opportunity for us is just what's happening, to try to develop programs where we can increase our staff, to find federal and state funding that are going to help us to grow the workforce, to find help from insurers to help us do things like, and I applaud Blue Cross for helping us with telehealth. So a telehealth visit, now they've helped us with reimbursement for that. So we're being reimbursed at the same level as an inpatient visit. That those kind of things help us to continue to deliver care in an innovative way so that our patients can have access to it. Not everything has to be an in-person visit. You're able to get a lot more done in the day with the telehealth visits.
You just mentioned Kate Walsh, who left Boston Medical Center, new head of Health and Human Services. I've known for a few days we were going to talk to you today. My ears perked up earlier this week when the news came out that Mary Lou Sutters, who was the last head of the Executive Office of Health and Human Services in the Baker administration, just joined a Boston lobbying firm called Smith, Costello & Crawford. Mass Health and Hospital Association, MHA, that you chair, is one of their clients. She's a senior policy advisor there now. What becomes possible for the 70 hospitals in your network if somebody who was the head of EOHHS is now lobbying on Beacon Hill?
I can't say enough for Secretary Sutters and the relationship we've had with her through the COVID crisis. If it wasn't for her coming to the table with her wonderful team, I don't think we would have gotten through the crisis in the very smooth manner that we did. It was a real collaboration that took time to work out, but we couldn't have had a better advocate on so many different levels. She talked with everyone from the local hospitals, the legislature, to meetings at the White House to get us what we needed to get through the day. I have every confidence in her now. If there's one person that can help us to continue to bridge the gap and to move forward, it's former Secretary Sutters.
When we talked with you in late February, sort of in advance of this conversation, you said, I think it was February 23rd, you said that it was the first time since March 16th, 2020, that Emerson Hospital had zero COVID patients and zero staff out because of COVID. Is that still the case today?
I think we have two out today. So yes, the numbers are very small. And we're not so much dealing with acute COVID flare-ups now. We're dealing with the aftermath of COVID, the lack of staff, the increase in infrastructure costs, supplies cost more, drugs cost more, construction costs are more. So all labor costs are more. In fact, that's the single biggest reason that most hospitals are having a negative margin today. So if there's one thing that we have to attack, it's that. At the same time, there's more people using the system, especially in the area of mental health. Today, I think we have 861 people waiting for beds, behavioral health beds, both adult and pediatric in Massachusetts. We have enough beds. We don't have enough staffed beds, which goes right back to where we started. Fixing the workforce issues together is the single most important thing to helping us to get our healthcare system back on track.
So is it fair to say that Christine Schuster, chair of Massachusetts Health and Hospital Alliance, is saying staffing, staffing, staffing.
And more staffing.
And
yes.
More staffing. All right. Christine Schuster, thanks so much for joining us. Good luck with your work over the next year.
Thank you for having me.
There is more ahead. I'm Tisiana Deering, and you are listening to Radio Boston.
And that is going to do it. The Celtics hang on.
And they did, to beat the Cleveland Cavaliers last night, 117-113. And then there's the Bruins, who continue to set kind of a ridiculous number of records as they raise expectations for playoffs from them. So there's a lot to talk about, and we want to break it all down with a sports roundup now. Joining us on the line, Jonathan Marshall, WMUR sports reporter. Welcome back, John.
How's it going, guys?
Doing well, and that means you know that here in Studio 2, WBUR's Chris Siderick is with us.
Hey, Chris. Let's do it.
All right. So listen, Jonathan, I want to start with the Celtics. They get the win last night but they're up at 21 at some point, and then they win by like four. So major headlines for you from the game last night.
Look, Cleveland's a good team. They're one of the top teams in the Eastern Conference, right? This is a possible playoff opponent, depending on how seeding works out. And so you have a team with Donovan Mitchell, Darius Garland, a talented big man duo, and Evan Mobley and Jared Allen. So that's a tough opponent. So kudos for the Celtics for bouncing back from that Knicks game, and Jason Tatum specifically from bouncing back from that Knicks game and having a huge game last night. Runs happen in the NBA. It's a win, and you got to appreciate a win against a quality opponent in the Eastern Conference. So to me right now, they just got to keep winning games, because at this moment, Milwaukee's the top seed in the East now. It's no longer the Celtics. So the Celtics are going to have to keep winning games if they want to have home court advantage, which is going to be huge in the playoffs. So you got to win. You got to win these games no matter what.
So wait, I'm going to go to Chris in a second, but I think I didn't realize this. Was the Knicks loss, was that the difference between the Celtics being at the top and going in with, you know, having favored home court advantage opportunity? Was that the Knicks loss that did that?
Pretty much, yep.
All right. And then, you know,
Milwaukee's been on fire lately.
Milwaukee has won a crazy amount of games lately as well. So you can't afford every game matters. Every game matters. Pretty much a half game difference between Milwaukee and Boston. So this is a crucial stretch.
I feel like cue the Darth Vader music there with Milwaukee. Now I'm going to be like, dun, 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 dun. So Chris Sidorek, I'll turn to you because the other thing that Jonathan Marshall mentioned there was Jason Tatum, who has been in a little bit of a slump, big in the All-Star game, right? But a bit of a slump since then. What did you see from him last night? Anything to ease worries?
Oh, yeah. It was a huge game from him. And he started out a little slow, but then really kind of took it over starting in the second quarter. He had 15 points in the second quarter and ended up with 41 for the game. He kind of did back and forth with Donovan Mitchell for the Cleveland Cavaliers and you know, did enough to put his team over the top. He did definitely start pretty slow out of the All-Star break and even kind of talked about that he had kind of put so much on that weekend and clearly showed, you know, with his All-Star game performance. That game has become so important to a lot of these players in terms of raising their overall brand and reputation around the league with other players in the league. But he talked about last night specifically how he kind of overcame that slump and kind of got back into the rhythm. And I want to play a little bit of that sound here.
Really got to the free throw line tonight. And I just got some easy ones early, right? You know, easy ones early, layup in transition, getting downhill, finishing at the basket, just kind of opens things up. It wasn't like I was discouraged or worried, you know, because I hadn't shot the ball that great out the break. Just came out with the mindset trying to find a way to win.
So I thought that was striking for a couple of reasons. One, he admits he you know, hasn't shot well since the All-Star break, says he wasn't worried, but you have to think at some point it's creeping into the back of his mind, right, that he's got to kind of overcome that hump. Second, there's a key thing to kind of watch for when he does start slow. He talks about those easy baskets, right? So in transition, when, you know, the Celtics make a steal or grab a rebound and kind of run down the floor before the other team can set up their defense, getting those baskets right close to the hoop where you don't have to, you know, if you're struggling shooting from three from long distance, you get those nice easy hoops, you get to the free throw line, you get those shots at your pace. It really helps you kind of settle into your game. And I thought he really did that last night in the show.
Okay. So with all of that sort of hanging in our heads, Jonathan Marshall, explain for people who may not know how a playoff system works, this home court advantage thing, how we get it and how important it might be to a Boston Celtics team.
Well, it's important for any team, right? If you want to compete, that means having that home court advantage in the playoffs where there's intensity, just having that crowd. There's a reason why these teams vie for that, right? Just having that extra home court support in the crowd when things get a little intense and sleeping in your own beds more often than not, right? During the playoffs when you're traveling, right? And so just avoiding extra travel, having to avoid going into hostile territory as much as possible. And so if Boston finishes in second in the Eastern Conference, they can still have home court advantage throughout the playoffs until the Eastern Conference Finals if they were to play Milwaukee. But that's why it's key to finish in that top spot so you can just guarantee yourself home court throughout the playoffs, regardless of who you're playing. So it's very crucial.
I would say, though, it's more important to some teams than others. And I think this is a core that's shown that they can win big games on the road. They won a game 7 in Milwaukee last year on their playoff run. So I don't think it's a make or break thing for them. I think they actually kind of relish being the villains on the road sometimes and playing in that environment. So it's more important for some teams than others. Obviously, if you have your druthers, you'd like to play home for a crucial game 7 if you can.
All right. Exactly. So I want to move to the Boston Bruins now. And Chris, I'll stay with you for just a second, just because, you know, several years ago now, when I first started on the show, you were like, you were going to turn me into a Bruins fan. And I was like, whatever. But I'm loving them. So I want to talk a little bit about pulling off the parquet, getting to the ice underneath and the TD Garden. They have won 8 in a row. What are your headlines for the Bruins?
Well, it's funny you mentioned that because this team has kind of morphed into a team that I think actually would suit your rooting interests.
It does.
They used to be kind of the hulking bruisers, right, that would out-hustle you and out-hit you in the corners and all of that. They've become this highly skilled, finely tuned scoring machine, right, where they're just doing their – you got these incredible highlight goals coming. But my ultimate highlight, hands down, is Linus Ullmark, their goalie, who has just been – I mean, head and shoulders above every other goalie in the league. And I know there was a moment recently that caught your attention. I want to play that here.
Connor Carlin off Besser's stick. Ullmark is going to try it, and he scores! Linus Ullmark, the odds-on Vezina Trophy winner, scores an empty net goal to seal this win!
So somebody resuscitate Jack Edwards. clearly a bit of a Bruins fan. No, but Linus Allmark scores a goal. First time a Bruins goalie's ever scored a goal. But he also set a record on Tuesday that I think is even more impressive. 54 saves in their win over the Calgary Flames. Jeez. That's the most saves by a Bruins goalie ever.
So hold on.
Explain what that means, though, for people who don't watch hockey.
It means that 54 out of the 57 times the puck came at him, he knocked it away.
Nice.
Right? So, I mean, it's just an unbelievable performance. And the Bruins got outshot 57-20 in that game and ended up winning anyway in overtime. So that tells you that this team is making the most out of their opportunity and that this goalie is really helping them reach their ceiling. But I will say the record that Allmark broke with those 54 saves, Tim Thomas, 52 saves back in 2011. I don't know if you remember 2011.
Tell us.
Some big things were happening. And in fact, that was the Bruins Cup season, right?
Yeah.
And I will add, Cup winners. Especially for Jonathan, that those 52 saves came against Philadelphia.
Jonathan, jump in.
Wow. No comment, Chris. No comment at all.
All right. So, Jonathan, yeah, I was going to say for listeners, you might like the Philly team. So, we're just going to put that out there. And now, jump in on these Bruins and on hockey this year.
Hey, Chris, I could mention the football season, but we're not going to do that. You know, we're not even going to talk
about it. Yeah, you're not going to do that because it didn't end well for you either.
It's okay. Now, as far as the Bruins, I mean, we've talked about this all season. I mean, they've proven the dominance. As far as, I mean, you look at the standings, it's the Bruins and then everybody else to me. Like, you know, when you look at what the Celtics are doing, they're in a tight race for their top spot. I think the Bruins have solidified themselves as the top team, not only in the East, but just the entire league. And they're doing it consistently, right? Like you look at what they've done, they're producing at a high rate, you know, as far as offensively, and they're doing it. They've been able to sustain it. And that's a team that you can trust when it comes to playoff time, because they really haven't had too many lows this season. They've reeled off six straight wins throughout the year. And so I think that proves that that's a team that's consistent in what they do.
So
that's trustworthy in the playoffs.
I hear you, Jonathan Marshall. And yet I worry about the grind. You know, Dan Shaughnessy of the Boston Globe says this week what happened in 1971 should be a cautionary tale for these Bruins. You and I have talked on air before, Jonathan, about the sort of the injuries and the wear and tear. Yes, they've been consistent, but how long can a body be consistent?
I mean, look, injuries are a part of the game, right? But this team has shown that they've been able to fight through different lows and different things like that throughout this season. If they are the best team that we think they are, it shouldn't matter. They're going to find a way. They're going to battle through. And you look, it's going to be a grind for any team if they make it to the Stanley Cup. It's going to be a grind. You got to figure it out.
Yeah.
And so if the Bruins are that team, they're going to do it.
That's so right. I mean, hockey playoffs, it is literally a grind. That is the whole challenge, basically, is can you survive that? But, you know, we've talked to Fluto Shinzawa from The Athletic a bunch of times in some of these sports roundups, and he's talked almost every time about the depth of this team. And with the trade deadline in the NHL tomorrow, I mean, it's the last chance to make any trades, adjust your roster. The Bruins have actually added a couple of pieces, including Tyler Bertuzzi today from Detroit. So they're actually just building on that depth, getting even deeper, which is kind of insane. And speaking of that, I just want to announce, because this has been hanging over the team basically all year, they finally signed David Pastrnak to an extension, 8-year, $90 million extension. He is arguably one of, if not the best player in the league, young star in your system. Locking this guy in for, you know, the foreseeable future is such a huge, huge development. Now they can really kind of focus on putting their heads down and making this playoff run.
All right. So, Jonathan Marshall, we have just about 2 minutes left, and I want to bring one other thing in, because I'm watching spring training games for the Boston Red Sox over the weekend. It's in the bottom of the ninth. It is tied 6-6. The bases are loaded. The batter's at the plate from the Atlanta Braves, and this happens.
Now, time called. Conley took too much time. He's out. He didn't have his eyes on the pitcher by the 8-second pitch mark on the pitch clock. And that's going to be the ball game.
Conley was headed to first. He thought it was going to be a penalty for a ball four. Oh, my goodness.
Oh, my goodness, Jonathan Marshall. And our last 90 seconds, Chris, what's happening there is all these new rules in baseball trying to catch younger audiences by, frankly, making the game shorter and putting clocks on things. Do you think there will be a quick adjustment here? Are we going to see more of this, Jonathan?
I think that, look, it's going to be a tough adjustment, because when you're used to playing a game a certain way, you're used to watching a game a certain way, especially with these players, you can be a creature of habit, right? And so there may be a couple moments, especially early on in the season, but as the season goes on, I think, I mean, they're going to have to adjust to it, or you may it's spring training, so there aren't much stakes into it, right? But in the, you know, as the season goes on, the playoff race, it will behoove them to get adjusted quickly. So I think they'll figure it out.
And Chris Siderek, 30 seconds.
Tiziana, you remember when you and I talked about the pitchers complaining about the new, you know, cracking down on using substances and things like that? They will complain. You'll hear players complain. You may hear fans complain. But ultimately, it's good for the game. They need to stay relevant. They need to stay exciting. And I think these changes, as long as the league enforces it pretty strictly at first, they'll settle in.
All right, so Chris Siderek, you sit tight. Jonathan Marshall, we're going to say thanks to you here, WMUR sports reporter. Always great to have you on the Sports Roundup.
Thank you, guys. Always fun.
All right, now listen, Chris, you sit tight, but before we go, we're going to say goodbye. Chris is our senior producer here at Radio Boston. It's his last day. He is off to mold an entire new generation of journalists and soundmakers at Boston College. Chris, we wanted to play for you a little bit of our favorites from your time here on Radio Boston.
I need to paint the picture for our listeners. Chris came to work today in professional attire with his button-up shirt, but over it, you're wearing a Red Sox jersey.
You got to wear the colors, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
This is from the 1989 hit movie Major League. Eddie Harris is a pitcher talking about the measures to which he goes to basically make the ball move when he's pitching.
Of course, if the umps are watching me close, I just rub a little jalapeno inside my nose, get it running, and if I need to load the ball up a little, just wipe my nose.
So, wait.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Thank you for elevating the discourse here.
Always here to bring the class. I consider that my role here on Radio Boston.
And then he does the rest on his own.
Just the crowd exploding. Hats come flying down out of the stands onto the ice. Big game one win. You could feel both kind of the crowd and the players. I felt like everybody just kind of wanted to say, hey, we all missed each other, and this was a real celebration of what this really can be.
You know, it may be stupid sports, right? It's a bunch of grown adults throwing a ball around a field and keeping track of points. Like, it doesn't matter in the grand scheme of things, but at the same time, it gives us such an opportunity to come together and to resume these cultural rituals we have and to feel connected.
The coolest interview that I was a part of this year was absolutely when we talked to Jessica Meir. She was an astronaut. She's from Maine.
You remember
she
this?
She was part of the first all-female spacewalk. And we talked to her from here on Earth in Studio 3 while she was hundreds of miles above the planet.
I still remember the microphone floating around.
We arranged it through NASA. And I just have to play a little bit of how the interview started because you could tell right away this was something special.
Station, this is Houston ACR. Please stand by for a voice check from WBUR.
You said kind of early on in the trail that, you know, that in this moment we're living, that someone will tell this story someday.
Yeah.
What do you think that's going to look like?
I don't know. And that's funny. We're, you know, they talk about a beginning, a middle, and an end of story. We're right in the middle. And, who knows how the end goes?
We don't know how the end goes, Chris, but we love you, and we want to wish you Godspeed.
All right, you got me with that last one. It's been a blast. It's been quite a ride.
All right, so you can't see all the team in the control room, but many here to wish you well. Chris Siderek, thanks for your time on Radio Boston.
I mean this with every ounce of my soul. Thanks for having me.
That's our show for today. I'm Tiziana Deering on behalf of the whole Radio Boston team. Thanks for listening. Tune in again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.